when you have higher power, you also have higher stakes. So usually, even in those situations, you still want to go with an AB if the C variant is not very, very different from the B.
Yeah.
And that's something that you know, people seem to not appreciate enough, which is that when you have a big sample size, that also means big risk. So per unit time that you're running the tests, you have bigger risk of losses if these variants are worse than the control.
Hey folks, it's Richard here from Experimentation Podcast. Today I've got a special guest, Georgi Georgiev. He's the managing director of WebFocus LLC. He's been involved as a web marketer and web developer for over 15 years. He's got a diverse range of experiences from owning and developing and managing dozens of online projects, SEO, Google AdWords, Google Analytics, and as a statistician consultant. And he has also he also runs the blog analyticstoolkit.com, full of all kinds of statistical calculators and tools for CROs. And he's recently launched his book. Well, not recently, but he launched it a few years ago. It's the Statistical Methods in Online A/B Testing. So welcome to the show, Georgi.
Thank you. Thank you for this intro, and I'm pleased to be here, Richard.
Awesome. So, look, you've got a very diverse background, quite a unique background for someone involved in CRO. So, it sounds like you've pretty much done pretty much the full stack of, you know, most online marketing efforts, from SEO, web development, AdWords, and, you know, obviously, you've delved deeper into statistics and within CRO. Can you tell our audiences how you got involved in where you are now with CRO?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think this experience is what makes some of my stuff so interesting for people, since I draw back on really many different skills. Higher education is in mathematics and also web development and network technologies. So from there, I have this web development background. I've coded a lot of websites and continue to do so myself. And I also had a lot of experience in marketing. SEO was the first thing that caught my fancy. Yeah, I was really amazed by the possibilities there, by the information that Google AdWords at the time provided through their, for example, keyword research tool. There was nothing like it back in the day. And from there, I slowly started understanding that doing the work is good, but you also need to analyze the results of your efforts and to be able to present and say, okay, here is what we did. Here is we achieved this increase in, let's say, new visitors or new leads or whatever. And so Google Analytics was a natural next step. I was, I think, one of the first to certify as a Google Analytics individual back in 2009. And from there, I've really doubled down on analytics. And as time went by and I was consulting clients and doing reporting for them, I started hitting this wall of, okay, you can only do so much with observational data. You can only do so much by taking a look at, okay, we did this change on, say, February 5th. How are we doing 1 month later or 2 weeks later compared to the period prior or the previous year? And I just, you know, wasn't able to fight the noise in the data from the so many different things that are happening both on the product or website that I was working on and outside, like in terms of seasonality, economic changes, technological advances and changes. I just was hitting the wall of, okay, you can't really draw causal links. You can't estimate the effect sizes of what you're doing by just doing that. So I started searching for, okay, how is it that people do it? What's the best way to do that? And obviously I ended up into the scientists, the scientific world, the world of scientific research, which is exactly where these kinds of questions have been answered for many decades, if not centuries. And that's where I became familiar with statistical methods. And yeah, I really appreciated the clarity that experiments give you in terms of, okay, here is what you did, and here is the effect of it without any of these infinite confounders that you would otherwise need to take into effect, into account, sorry. And yeah, as you mentioned,
you basically were just scratching your own itch, right? Like you were like, okay, I can do these marketing efforts, and I can release this output, this report, but what do we do with the data? And how do we separate signal from noise, so to speak? How do we interpret the data and so forth? So, it sounds like you went into a really deep dive because, I mean, you said, before the show that you didn't have a degree in statistics or anything like that. It sounds like you had quite a bit of solid mathematical background, but I'm guessing you were just so passionate about what you were trying to solve that you just ended up becoming an expert in the field.
yes, indeed. And I would say that what helped me the most were the efforts that I put into developing tools myself. So I was actually coding the things that I was reading about and not just, blindly using someone else's work, and also running simulations of the different statistical methods. So for example, you can take a t-test or a z-test, and you can in like 10 lines of code a simulation which would tell you the performance of this test under varying conditions. You can vary the parameters and see how it behaves, and I think this is the best way to understand any statistical method that you are looking to apply in your work. If you have a little bit of a coding background, there are a plethora of tools out there that you can use, free tools including like R, Python, I think if you are serious about stats, that's the best way, the most efficient way. Like a few days of doing that is probably better than a couple of months of a statistical course at any college or university, I would say.
So getting your hands dirty, diving into the deep end of things, and knowing how to, basically kind of knowing, you knew everything, you knew everything from a school perspective, in terms of the setup end to end. Like you're basically, like you didn't have like any of the free tools that we had, that we're sort of blessed with right now. Free or paid, you were basically doing a lot of things very manually, weren't you?
I mean, back in the day, obviously there was R, but there were very few other tools. There was very little written on the topic, especially with regards to A/B testing, online experimentation. It was fairly new. I mean, Ronnie Kuhavis, say 2008. Paper, I think it was one of the best intros back then to the topic. It was still fairly new. I mean, not widely known, I would add. And it was very difficult to find information. You would go into papers on medical studies or psychological studies or econometrics, and you would try to extract from there what methods work for what situations, what would apply to A/B testing. How you make it actually work with the data you have. There was so few written about it back in the day. Now it's much easier. So
would you recommend our audiences to like look at to really look at analyze the scientific method that the medical industry uses, scientists use, the random randomized controlled trial, mm-hmm. which is A/B testing essentially. Would you recommend deep diving if they wanted to really get into it, like really understand the papers and so forth that they come from that field? Because that's essentially where we're getting it from, aren't we? Like, in a sense, like the whole A/B testing framework is really the scientific method applied on a website, right?
It is. So nowadays there are a lot more that one can find in terms of articles, books.
Yeah.
So it's not as necessary to go into the source materials, let's say. But yes, if you want a really good understanding, it definitely helps. But it should be noted that actually in online A/B testing, we have it much easier than most of the sciences, to be honest. Like we can actually experiment on whole populations. We don't suffer from many of the external validity or generalizability, as it's called, issues faced by many of the sciences. So let's say in a medical trial, you start recruiting volunteers, patients for treatment. Well, how are you doing the selection? Is it representative of what the trial outcomes are going to be generalized to afterwards? That's a very difficult task to manage. And in online A/B testing, we don't need to care about that at all, right? So our task is actually very much simpler. So some of what you will read in these more scientific papers may not apply or may not be of a concern. Another thing is the sample sizes. So especially traditionally, in most sciences, you work with very small sample sizes, so performance at those levels is crucial, and understanding how that relates to statistical power is crucial. With online A/B testing, obviously, you still have the issue of sample size, regardless of the how many users your product is serving,
yep.
But you can much more easily lean, let's say, onto methods which rely on some kind of an asymptotic distribution assumptions, asymptotic performance, unlike many of the sciences where you're limited to by just the sheer amount of the small amount of data that you have available.
This is Roman Santiago from Experiment Nation. Every week we share interviews with and conference sessions by our favorite conversion rate optimizers from around the world. So if you like this video, smash that like button and consider subscribing. It helps us a bunch. Now back to the episode.
I just want to deep dive into an article you released, I think it was about a month ago. It was basically a meta-analysis of 1001 A/B tests. And I think this is the follow-up to the 115 test meta-analysis that you did maybe a few years back. Very, very good meta-analysis that's on your analytics toolkit platform. Do you want to just give us some sort of background and motivation and why you wanted to run this meta analysis and go from there?
Yeah, sure. So my first meta analysis that was based on data from Good UI, and like they collect a lot of experiments and their outcomes and collate them for you. So back then I discovered a lot of possible issues. Obviously none of it can be said firmly, but let's say one of the eye-popping numbers for me was how many tests were underpowered. So they lacked the necessary statistical power related to, you know, what would be a reasonable range of effect sizes for me as a external observer. And some hinted at other issues like peeking into the data. I was curious to see, okay, how has the profession developed? Are we now better at applying statistical methods? And also I was curious whether my efforts in developing the analytics toolkit were paying off in terms of, okay, are people actually running better, more robust tests, more informative tests. And also another issue was that the first data set may not have been unbiased, meaning that it might have contained more optimistic results than were warranted. And so I wanted to just take, okay, this is going to be a random sample from our platform. It's not going to, we're not going to, you know, skew the data in any way. We'll make sure to remove any any outliers, etc. And yeah, some interesting insights from that in terms of test sample sizes, test durations. So we found out that people are actually now much more aware about external validity concerns. So they're running tests for longer. We no longer see these like tests run for a day or two. And then a conclusion is, is reached, which is, even if it can be statistically valid, it just doesn't make sense in terms of, okay, how representative are these 1 or 2 days of users on your website for the whole year or 2 years or however long you expect this solution to, be implemented on the website for. It just doesn't make sense. And
What year was the initial test done?
I think 2018.
Okay, so it's been 4 years since then. Okay.
Yes. And also these tests were gathered over a period of several years, is my understanding. So they maybe spanned 2012, 2018. Yep. And now the current selection of tests is almost entirely from 2022. So it's much newer data set.
Okay. How about we deep dive into some of the things that you mentioned here that stood out? I'm just reading a few things in my show notes. There's quite a few things that you've written down. One thing that I noted is the arithmetic mean of the A/B test durations is, 35.4 days, which is basically 5 weeks. Was that notably different to the previous meta-analysis?
Yeah, for the previous one, we didn't have this information, unfortunately. That was also another goal of this analysis because we have a much richer data set. And previously, we didn't know the durations. We knew the sample sizes, but not how long it took for these sample sizes to be reached necessarily. And yeah, I mean, just looking at this mean and the distribution, it seems like people are really aware that they need to run tests for longer just to ensure external validity. And also, it could be also a byproduct of, okay, we need to have sufficient statistical power to detect smaller effect sizes because these are so prevalent, as one of the other findings of the analysis actually shows. The distribution of lift estimates is such that a lot of the effects that you won't expect from your tests is very small, either positive or negative, but very small, which means you need to prepare to wait for longer to be able to detect them. But it's also important to do so because otherwise you're missing on these small incremental steps, which would build a good product over time.
I mean, test duration is something that I thought about myself, and I've read different, blogs online, and I'll just put it out there. So I've heard a sort of general heuristic of maybe 4 to 6 weeks, just to get enough, which is probably seen as long enough to get enough statistical data, but then not too long so that, you're having X amount of people clearing their cookies on their browser or so forth. What's your thoughts on that? Because, I mean, obviously the longer you run a test, the higher the chance of the population involved in that test are going to clear their cookies. What percent of them do in reality, I don't know. And the percent that do clear their cookies and go back into your test, either in the control or the variant, how much noise do they really add to that test? So do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, this issue is developing as we speak. And that's definitely a reason for not running tests for too long, unless you're doing that on users you can permanently identify, let's say users who are registered on your platform only. So on the acquisition side, obviously we don't have that luxury. So there, I would say you should go based on if you know the rate at which cookies are deleted, then you can definitely take that into account. I'm not sure what the current statistics are, as well as whether there is any wide discrepancy between browsers. But let's say, I think one of the major issues right now is how frequently a user revisits your website. So if it's a user who is revisiting your website every several days, least, then I think the cookie deletion issue shouldn't be present. But if it is a website with less frequent interactions, then it could be more pronounced. But then again, if it's, I think it's also about the number of returning visitors. But depending on whether you can measure them reliably. I mean, it's a thorny issue. It's a thorny issue for sure. But on the other hand, if you submit too much to it, then that means you might be missing a lot of true improvements simply because you refuse to be exposed to that issue. And yeah, if you're concerned about it, I would say run a few simulations. Like it's not that easy to simulate a set of data. Okay, we have 100,000 users here. These are properly randomized and properly tracked. And now let's add another 50,000 to those, which, you know, will have some dependency. And then those will be re-randomized to the treatment and control group and see how that affects our estimates, whether it's meaningful or not. I think it's going to be a difficult matter still, but
an area that CROs don't have maybe not necessarily have a clear sort of agreement on, from what I've heard on podcasts and reading stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not something I can give a recipe for. Like, okay, do this and you'll be safe, or don't do this and, you know, unless you want to screw it up. I think it may be something people are overly concerned about, just like, let's say, one such issue is running tests concurrently. And so many people are very wary of doing that. They think that the interactions effects are going to creep in and ruin their analysis. But actually, the solutions that are proposed for this problem are much worse than the problem itself. And usually you can actually run concurrent tests without worrying too much about interactions. And I think it might be the case for cookie deletion here, but I don't have the solid data to prove that. It's not an area I've spent so much time investigating, to be honest.
Well, anyway, that's something that I'll have to probably deep dive in the future. What's another highlight that you found in the tests? The meta analysis.
I think that would be the lift estimates for me. These were the biggest surprise, since I was expecting, first of all, for them to be sort of normally distributed. So you have about half of them on one side, half of them on the other side. Mm. And then you have the most effects would be closer to zero, but then you would have a lot of other effect sizes, let's say plus 10%, minus 15%, plus 25%, etc. Instead, what we see is that all the results are bunched around zero. So you have many slightly negative outcomes and many slightly positive outcomes. And this is something which is which should be taken into account, because it really, on the one hand, highlights the need for A/B testing. Because if you don't A/B test, these small negative effects, they can all be missed. If, for example, if you try to do something like implement and then compare before and after, usually the variance in that data is so big that such small hits that you're taking to your performance are not going to be noticed, and so you're just gonna, you know, run happily into the future without understanding that you're incurring these many small performance hits. And on the other side, for the positive ones, this should bring people's attention to the fact that they need to power their tests properly, which means they need to take into account that the sample size that they plan should allow them to reliably detect small lifts of 2, 3, 5%, you know. And because otherwise they would be suffering from the curse of too many false negatives. And I've had this example that I've been giving of a company that's a real case, not my client, but I know that it's a real case. They started A/B testing. Yep. They ran about 70 A/B tests, and they gave up on testing actually at that point. Wow. And why was that? The reason is that they only saw 3 statistically significant winners from these 70 tests. And why is that a bad decision? So one, they might have been like really bad at choosing what to test, at the changes that they were testing. Like they could have been, really bad. Well, in this case, A/B testing saved them from implementing 67 changes that would have either made no change or most likely would have slightly hurt or more significantly hurt their performance. So yep. A/B testing was actually doing its job in this case. On the other hand, I honestly don't believe that much in this hypothesis. The other hypothesis I have is that they actually were not powering their tests properly. So they were running tests for too short a time with too few users. And their effect sizes were probably in the range of 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, but they had very little probability of detecting those true lifts because of the short test duration. And that's what underestimating power can do for you. You just end up saying, okay, this thing is useless. Like we can't A/B test because it's impossible that all of our ideas or practically all are bad.
And yeah. Do you think? I mean, that's alluding to your comment here that you said here that majority of the tests were powered at 80%. However, a significant minority, maybe about a third, is powered at 90%. You see, this is encouraging since 80% power offers a fairly low chance of detection of a true effect of the target minimum effect of interest. That's basically what you're alluding to, isn't it?
Yeah, that's another way to look at the problem. Is okay. 80% power is kind of like textbook example.
Yeah, textbook. Like any sort of calculator you bring up, like I used to see Excel calculators, like it's always set to 80%, which seems to be. Could you explain to our audiences why 80% is just seen as the? This helps out me too. Like, why is it set at that level? Is there a historical reason for that or?
Yeah, I think it's just convenient to I think part of it is custom. So once the founding fathers of statistics say, okay, let's examine the power curve at 80% power.
Yeah.
And then everybody starts doing that. So that's one thing. And another thing is, 80% power is an informative number. So it's a fairly high probability. It's like not like 50% or 10%. If you think about it, a 20% chance of missing a true effect of this size is actually pretty big, big number. So more and more people are calling for, okay, you should actually be looking at 90% power, even higher sometimes, because even 90% is 1 in 10, and it's still fairly high, but it makes sense since this is the error of secondary concern, false negatives. So for power, I think the most helpful thing for you to understand how it works is to just examine the power distribution of a single test in its entirety. So you would see where the test has 0% power, where it has 10% power, where it has 50, 80, 90%. And this will give you a really good understanding of what you're doing when you're just examining the power curve at 80%. And the power level here refers to the power level that the experimenter chose in the interface. I can give a tip to your listeners, it would be examine the power curve as a whole for most of your tests. This would give you a better idea of the capacity of your test to detect true effects of different sizes. So let's say I'm looking at the power curve right now and it says 80% power to detect a true effect size of roughly 9% lift. Mm-hmm. And Yeah, okay, that's informative. But I can also look at 4% lift and see that the test has 30% power there. So I can be thinking, okay, how likely is it that this effect size would be beneficial if I can detect it, you know, if it truly exists. And yeah, in most cases, 4%, you really want to have more than 30% power there for 4% lift. And yeah, it will also highlight the difference between power and power level, because the power level is something we set and we okay, let's say it's 80%. We examine the power function at that level and we see what effect size we can detect. That's fine. But you can always get more information by just looking at the whole thing and not just one point on it, is what I'm trying to say.
Actually, I think it's quite interesting that the vast majority of tests, i.e. 88% for your platform, included just one test variant and a control. Only 10% had two variants and just 2% included three or more variants. So would you say that that's in some ways alluding to the maturity of A/B testing?
Well, this number can actually be interpreted in different ways. It's obviously all speculation on my part, since obviously I don't know how what the users are thinking exactly when they're designing these tests. I think either approach is fine. A/B test is fine. ABN is fine. Like, you can have 10 variants if you want against the control. But I think the prevalence of simple A/B tests shows that most practitioners understand that unless they have a drastically different variant, which has sort of an independent chance of, you know, being better than both the control and their first variant, let's say, then adding variants spuriously, like, okay, we have this one variant, which is, we're very happy, we're very, you know, we're confident it's going to be the current experience. Yeah. But let's tweak the color of this button or the position of this text by, you know, one section. We change two sections to be above the other. And I mean, small changes like these are very unlikely to result in meaningful differences. And it's usually more efficient to just test the best thing that you can come up now. And then to run a follow-up test to try to refine it after. Then to run a big ABN test with variants which are just slightly different than each other. Simply because it comes with the cost of a longer test duration, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
But the chance of, you know, there has to be independent chance of each of these variants to outperform the control. They shouldn't be like very close variants of each other. That's the point.
Yeah, I guess it's like, you know, looking at it from a cost-benefit analysis.
Exactly.
Would you say that maybe the exception could be like, say you've got a, I don't know, a test that's affecting pretty much the whole website. Let's just say it's the footer or the nav, the nav bar, you know, and you're doing two variants against the control. Maybe the variants are visually different enough to warrant having two variants. Would you say that that may be the exception? Because even though you are splitting up the traffic with two variants even further, because the test is basically on a global footer or navigation, you're getting quite a high level, high level traffic compared to like just a single page. I'm just sort of simplifying it here, but you know what I mean? There might be exceptions to the rule.
Well, when you have higher power, you also have higher stakes. So usually, even in those situations, you still want to go with an AB if the C variant is not very, very different from the B.
Yeah.
And that's something that people seem to not appreciate enough, which is that when you have a big sample size, that also means big risk. So per unit time that you're running the test, you have bigger risk of losses if these variants are worse than the control, like truly worse. Or if they are truly better, you're running a higher risk of, you know, missing out on revenue. Because if you run...
You mean when you say loss, you mean business impact? Like actual,
Exactly. Like revenue.
What's happening to the bottom line of the business. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, and obviously if the test is just on a, if it's on a lead form or something else, then you would measure the loss in that term, but it usually is just a proxy for some business metric. So if you're measuring the number of leads, like a lead conversion rate, then it proxies into revenue, obviously, because typically, you know, number of leads translates into revenue. I would actually recommend, obviously, to just run the test on average revenue per user when you can, simply because that is the easiest to interpret and to tie into actual business outcomes. But yeah, that could be a side topic to consider.
I think another thing you noted, which is of interest, was that about a third of A/B tests have a statistically significant outcome. What was it like compared to the previous meta-analysis? Do you have numbers for that?
The previous was 27. So on that front, it didn't seem biased, you know. But it is the 33% is fairly in line with other estimates that we can see in the industry. So it wasn't a big surprise there. I think it's a good number to strive for your experimentation program. If you have, let's say, an in-house team doing that, or you're an agency doing that, simply because I know a decent amount of the users of the platform are fairly high profile CROs with many years of experience, many big projects behind their backs. And if they can't beat the 33% number, then, I mean, even getting there should make you feel good. But also a caveat here, obviously, is that it depends on what you're testing. So if you implement experimentation as part of your development flow, so you're testing every single change or most changes done to the website or app, then obviously you would expect a smaller percentage of positive outcomes if you're doing superiority tests, because obviously, you know, some changes would just be zero effect. So yeah, depending on the mix of tests that you're doing, but I would say for tests where you're aiming for an improvement, or you're not just testing, okay, is this implementation going to break my website? This number looks like an upper limit, I would say.
I think the one third did resonate with me because I remember hearing Ronnie Garvey say in a podcast, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he was saying like, you know, you can kind of expect, third winners, third losers, and a third don't do anything is a kind of a heuristic. And like you said, like, these are the high-level CROs, right? Like, these are, like, in these people have been for years. So, you know, you're basically expecting a flip of a coin, maybe even a little bit lower than that, to get your winners out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think this should give, because I know people would probably have success rates lower than that typically. And so they shouldn't feel too bad about that. I mean, obviously they should strive to improve, but they shouldn't get discouraged by a lower success rate. Or on the other hand, if your success rate is suspiciously high, let's say 50, 60, 70, 80%, then maybe, you know, something in your process needs to be revised so it is more stringent and doesn't allow willing or unwilling, cheating of the system, if you will, like producing nominal winners, but they are not actual improvements, you know, to the extent that these are. Obviously, among these, I would expect there to be false positives as well. This would be controlled very well by the stats.
I've heard of Twyman. I think it's called Twyman's law. Basically, the more unusual or interesting the data, the more likely they are to have been the result of an error or one of a kind. Basically, if something's good, too good to be true, it probably is, right? So just have that at the back of your mind, because I'm... You hear on like maybe blogs or whatever about, you know, XYZ company doubling their conversions or revenue overnight or whatever, some crazy number, and you're like, okay, yeah, what's really happening here?
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of wild claims still floating in the in the industry, I would say. They are getting less and less prominent, I think. But yeah, I would be happy to see a bit more robustness in some of these claims and a bit more data, to be honest, because sometimes you just get a single number. For example, it's going to be so much easier to spot these issues if you, instead of presenting just the lift, present the confidence interval around it. Like, say what your uncertainty is. Yeah. I mean, say you achieved 50% lift. Good. What's the confidence interval? Is it from 49 to 51% or is it from 2% to 150, right? Because it's a big difference, you know. The one is very narrow and it says, okay, statistically, if you haven't done anything untoward, that's a super, super solid result, very trustworthy. And in the other example, it's like, okay, I mean, you could have achieved, you know, just 1% lift, but yeah, you know, it's like, no, it's just not as impressive anymore. So yeah, just reporting.
It's not going to create a newsworthy headline. It's all about clicks and impressions these days.
Well, I wouldn't say so, because if it was, then I wouldn't have the audience that I do. But I think a lot of people are actually really, really interested in doing their job right and knowing that they did it, that they did everything in their power to, you know, rule out biases or other issues that might be affecting their tests, and that they are actually delivering value to their customers, or you know, getting value if they're on the customer side and evaluating the work of a CRO agency or someone else. I think there is a lot of interest in the robustness of testing and the trustworthiness, as Ronnie says it, of the results.
You did mention about sequential testing. Excuse me for my ignorance. I'm not very aware of sequential testing. Could you explain what it is for the audiences?
Sure. So sequential testing basically is what you need to do when you are tempted at looking at your results every day or every week and making a decision when you see a significantly positive or a significantly negative outcome. If you do that without sequential testing, so you're just using regular, like, some free tool out there, some free calculator, which you just input, okay, here's my sample size, here's my outcome, give me the statistical significance. Well, surprise, surprise, this calculator actually makes the assumption that you have only evaluated your data once. And if this assumption is not true, then anything it gives you is, you can just dispense with it. It has zero value. And so, how do you satisfy your curiosity and desire to act quickly? And how do you satisfy the business person or stakeholders who demand that underperforming tests are stopped as early as possible and overperforming tests are also stopped as early as possible? One for the reason of cutting losses and the other for the reason of maximizing the positive benefits from a test. Well, you develop a sequential testing procedure. And this is exactly what happened. And this was actually first developed just during World War II, actually, in the USA. And then these procedures were obviously developed over time, expanded, extended, perfected, if you will. And yeah, nowadays we have a solid literature, a vast experience. It's actually the norm in many of the sciences where these risk reward calculations are where they matter, and yeah, I would say it's making its way in almost all sciences, perhaps without, but yeah, I think physics as well. Yeah, even there, I mean, it costs a lot to run, let's say, the Large Hadron Collider for a month. So yeah, you want to get results as quickly as possible. That's fine. That's actually good efficiency. You want to stop early if the results are already positive or negative. And that's what sequential testing does. It allows you to do that while maintaining statistical rigor. And also, if it's a well thought out process, it should also retain a lot of the external validity of the results. So you wouldn't be stopping, let's say, on the first day or the first hour of your analysis. You should be waiting for, you should be conducting analysis on whole business cycles. So typically a week, that would be a 1 week, and so on a weekly basis. Sometimes a daily analysis is also justified. And yeah, this is the whole idea. You want to run tests efficiently without invalidating the statistical assumptions, without sacrificing the statistical rigor.
Yeah. Instead of like, you know, doing your pretest calculations and then and having this fixed data that you kind of run the test by, which is maybe seen by some people as maybe a bit rigid, you're analyzing the data as you run the test. And, you know, you've got some sort of stopping rule involved there. And it sounds like it's a lot more, it involves more statistically rigorous kind of setup. Would you say that it's in some ways has some relation to, I've done like multi-arm bandit tests. It was basically for this email marketing platform. And it was like, wow, this variant's doing well. We'll just put more traffic towards this variant. I don't know if there's any relation to
that. There is, in terms of like the stochastic processes that are being studied, but we won't go into those details. The idea of bandits is a bit different than sequential tests, though. Bandits want to improve the performance during, you know, the time that they're being run, while a test wants to get you to a conclusion as quickly as possible. It's a bit different. So in terms of how you balance the exploration and exploitation phase, so with bandit, it's like, okay, we can explore indefinitely. With tests, it's like, okay, we need an outcome by this date. And also, I think estimation, so the effect size and confidence intervals, things like that, are much more the focus of sequential tests, and much less the focus of a bandit, which just aims to give you the performance and estimation from this data is possible, obviously, but much more difficult. And from what I understand, less efficient, meaning to get the same accuracy of estimation from a bandit or from a adaptive sequential test, which is also one possibility. So even in a sequential test, you can adapt the allocation between variants. So you can switch, you can allocate more users towards a variant, which seems more promising at the time. But then the analysis is much more difficult statistically, and also it's less efficient. So a sequential test without adaptation of this kind will take shorter to run than an adaptive sequential test. So yeah, I think at best they are equal in terms of what you get at the end, like when you draw the line at the bottom, what you get in the end, they're at best equal, and perhaps the simpler designs are a bit better in some situations.
Well, you did mention, going back to meta-analysis, that you said 20, well, at least 26% in terms of average efficiency improvement versus equivalent fixed sample size tests. Can you explain that a little bit further, if you don't mind?
Sure. So the whole idea of analyzing data as it comes is that you want to stop early, or earlier than when you would stop with the same test parameters. So you have the same significance threshold or confidence threshold, as it is also called. Yep. You have the same target minimum factor of interest, and you want to maintain a good power level against that, so 80%, 90%, whatever you chose. So you want to maintain all of these parameters, but stop test earlier to either save you from losses from underperforming variants, or you know, make it quicker to get to exploiting the benefits of an actual improvement. And so here the major thing that you want to measure is how long on average does it take to run a test? And with sequential tests, the benefit is that on average, they would stop sooner. And in the case of agile sequential testing in particular, in a real world scenario, it stops 25, 26, 28%, depending on some assumptions being made. But in this range for sure, earlier than if you had designed the same exact tests, but run them with a fixed sample size on the same data, essentially. And yeah, this is a quarter of the, saving in terms of performance. And this translates to the bottom line, actually, because it means less lost revenue and higher earned revenue from winners. And yeah, I think that's significant. It's nowhere near the limit of where theoretically sequential testing can get you. So depending on the actual distribution of the true effect sizes, it can be as efficient as much as 80% faster. So if you're actually, the tests that you're running have actually much bigger positive or negative outcomes, not outcomes, but true effects, then you can be 80% faster on average, which is
that can be huge in terms of cost savings to a business and lessening risk.
Sorry, just to final remark on that. Yeah, what we've seen in practice is that since these lift estimates are really concentrated around zero and then relative to the minimum factor of interest, they're really in a region where they're not reaching this maximum efficiency. You know, the range is from 20% to 80% efficiency. The real world observed efficiency is 26 to 28, let's say. And that's what you would expect if you're running tests similar to the tests that were run on our platform during
I would still call 26% though in the real world.
Yeah, 26 world.
It's still quite a material difference though.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Indeed. Very, very material.
And just lastly, you made another point that half of A/B tests have 90% probability to detect a true effect of 6% or less, while the average NDE is 11.3%, suggesting a trend towards better power tests becoming the norm among professionals. Any comments on that?
Yeah, sure. One of the major findings of the previous meta-analysis was that a lot of tests were actually not very well powered. Only 2/3 of tests had a minimum detectable effect below 10% lift.
Yeah.
So in this analysis, but in the previous, it's just 1/4. So only 25% of tests had the ability to detect a lift of 10%, and 10% is huge if you look at the distribution of the actual effect sizes.
It's huge.
And what typically makes, and also if you think about it, because it's not only about what you expect to see, but also what would make business sense to test. Because, I mean, yes, you would be super happy with 10% improvement, but aren't you going to be happy with 2 or 3%? For most businesses, the answer is yes. But with underpowered tests, you would miss those true effects of 2 and 3% way too often, like 90% of the time, 80% of the time, which is unacceptable. The finding here is, experimenters are much more realistic in the choice of the target minimum detectable effect, the minimum effect of interest, as they call it, and they're consequently they're running tests for longer with larger sample sizes, so that the false negative rate is much better for this new meta-analysis.
Just a comment from my end. I mean, I'm obviously not a stats expert like yourself, but I've kind of read like blogs and so forth saying, set your NDE at, 5%. Mm-hmm. What's your comments of that in line with your meta-analysis results that you've got here?
Yeah, 5% is a good, I would say, guideline. No, not guideline. It's a good starting point. Yeah. I'm actually an advocate for using the minimum effective interest, which makes sense for the particular test. So for each test, you would see, okay, at which point on the effect on the effect size range is it where the test is beneficial for the business? Yeah, so for smaller businesses, typically the sample sizes that they can achieve in a meaningful amount of time are smaller, and so their power is bound to be smaller, to be worse, and so for them slightly higher effects can still make sense, because otherwise they might end up running tests for a whole year or half a year, and at half a year you are slowing down your process so much, and you're waiting so long time, and you're also running into all these issues that we touched on earlier with cookie deletion and the like. And yeah, you know, maybe there the balance would be, let's say it's at 10%, maybe. But
so having a strict 5% isn't viable for all businesses, because you know, the lower you go in your MDE, the higher the sample size has to be, right? To get the effect, and the longer you've got to run your test for.
Exactly. And then on the other side, if you're already a big business with a lot of or the experiment that you're doing involves a lot of people, and then even a 1% lift could be super significant for the business. It could mean let's say tens of millions of dollars per year. Might be 1% lift for larger businesses, and there you obviously want to power for these effects, because you don't want to miss let's say 20 or 30 million lift equivalent, because so their 5% is like, what, like that's like billions for us if we detect this. But if we miss it, you know, if we miss just 4% lift, it's like it can be game changing for our business. So 5% is just okay, maybe an average business somewhere out there, 5% would be great for them, but is there such a business? I mean, and also I like to think about individual tests instead of businesses, because even if you take like a big corporation like Microsoft, they could have tests involving billions of users, or they could have tests on some niche feature or niche product, which only you know, attracts a couple of thousand of users per week. So it's all about what you're testing and what the particular balance is for that particular test. And that's actually something that I've worked a lot on. I've published articles on it. I have developed a tool to actually allow you to compute where that optimum lies for each particular test. It obviously takes more information into account. It requires some business information. For example, how much does it cost you to run this test in terms of fixed costs? So that's your sunk cost, which no matter what the outcome of the test is, you're putting into. And other things like that, like the monthly impact on revenue. What's the revenue impacted by the test? So it's a big factor, because it's much different if you stand to lose, as I just explained, like if what you're testing can impact hundreds of millions of revenue per week, it's much different in terms of the balance of risk and reward compared to if it's just impacting $10,000. So
in other words, the MDE is not a one size fits all sort of thing. Yes. It really depends. Just to round it off, you did mention this in your book. This is a shameless plug. I actually am reading this book. Statistical methods in online A/B testing. Kind of halfway through, maybe three quarters through. So it's quite a good read. It will give you the whole framework of things and all things statistics as well as CRO. Thanks a lot for coming on the show, Georgi. Is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Thank you for having me, Richard. It was a pleasure, and I hope it was a useful conversation for yourself and for all the listeners out there. And I think the industry is moving in a great direction. I'm seeing it happen in front of my eyes, and I'm very happy to contribute as humbly as I do to it. And if any of your listeners wants to, you know, drop me an email about any of the topics that we touched on, I'd be happy to, you know, to respond. And yeah, I say let's keep in touch. And I really like the work that you do here at Experiment Nation. I think it's also having this positive impact. And yeah, so very happy to be part of it.
Awesome. How can people contact you again? I mean, you're on LinkedIn, so I can just Google. Go on LinkedIn.
Yeah, LinkedIn is the best. I'm constantly there, so I should be fairly quick to approve a request for you know, for connection there. And I think I also have my contact details listed there. So yeah, that shouldn't be an issue.
Awesome. And analytics-toolkit.com. It's got all the bells and whistles to do with A/B testing, calculations, and so forth. So have a look. And yeah, thanks for coming on the show. See you around.